I will create your new look. I will have men dying at your feet. $10 extra, and Brian will shoot your video.
20.
He doesn't even know me.
Debbie, he is only like the next Martin Scorsese.
Okay. Okay.
You're listening to the Hollywood Saloon.
I've always felt that it'd be wonderful if I could shoot a film the way I see things, literally the way I see things as I'm walking around. And I happen to move very quickly. I walk fast and I talk fast, and I see things quickly, I think. And I've tried to formulate it into a style. And it is literally like taking the eye, the heads of the people in the audience and grabbing them by the back of their hair and forcing them to see things by different cuts and camera moves, the way I see them, or the way I get impressions that I see them. They're really impressions of what I see and movement. I'm really annoyed that I can never really get certain camera moves fast enough. I'm trying to capture the way I perceive things. I use the word perceive rather than see, because I could see something, but I'll remember it in some sort of, maybe in a different perception, maybe a different image, or it expressed another way. It'll be as if the camera zoomed in, or it'll be as if the camera tracked from left to right parallel, you know, but actually I was moving another way, but that's the way I remember it. And I try to get those images in my mind, those impressions, through moves, camera moves or cuts. Actually, through cuts, that's even more fun. And I just like to enjoy it, that's all. I like to enjoy when I make a picture.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Hollywood Saloon. I'm Andy.
I'm John.
And welcome to this crazy thing that we call film style. Now, I think this is a subject that has been talked about a lot. We all know it, whether or not we know how to say it or not. But we all know it. We all see it. It's what pleases us when we watch a film. Even if we can't, after the fact, sit down and say, well, this is what I thought about this shot. This is what I thought about that shot. It's something that you play with. It's something that... There's been a massive growth of it from the beginning of film, the beginning of film history. And I think that what we're going to look at today on the Hollywood Saloon is we're going to go through some of that and see how it came about, how it was developed, and where it is now, and even where the future is of it, or what we'd like to see at least. So it's a fascinating journey into that. And like I said, even if you don't know right now, you do know what we're talking about. But let's just dive in. So when I say style...
That's a very good question. What is style?
That's the question. What is style?
You know, where does it come from? But I mean, most importantly, what is style? How do you define it? And I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, style is all around us. Style is in every choice, in every cut, in every shot.
Film style.
In every visual medium. And I know a lot of times we relate everything back to music. I mean, it's just a common thing, but I think films and cinema has more to do with music than it does, say, with plays. In terms of plays, you're telling a basic story on stage to where you don't need any camera angles. Your eye picks out what it wants to see on stage. It either looks at the whole stage as one long shot, or it might break things up to people. You know, your eyes moving here and you're panning here and whatnot. So in the early days of theater, you know, before any kind of photography or any kind of film, any way to record it, the audience dictated their own style in terms of what was presented to them and what they chose to look at.
Sure.
But to talk about style, to me, I think you have to go all the way back to the beginning.
Edwin S. Porter really was the one with the Life of the American Fireman, I think, that started intercutting. And creating an emotional impact in the audience by intercutting two shots that are not related to each other. One scene is going on at one place, basically the firemen rushing to a fire with their horse-drawn wagons. And the other scene is the fire, miles away. And you intercut the two, and you understand psychologically and emotionally that these people's lives are in danger, and these people are coming to rescue them, and you're rooting all of a sudden for that to happen, and you're hoping they save the people. I often think about what it must have been like to be there to create the art form as it was happening and say, why don't we try this? That doesn't make any sense. I mean, we do it in the editing room now. We cut to something and say, well, that doesn't work. Well, imagine what they must have said in 1904.
But the invention of editing is the thing that allowed film to take off. It's the equivalent of the invention of flight. Both human-powered flight and motion picture editing were invented in the same year, and they have similar kinds of effect.
Well, Griffith, of course, was the master. I mean, everything that we know of today was done at one time by him. He just used every possible device in order to tell a story. And as far as dramatic films are concerned, Griffith is the one always to go back and study.
We owe everything to Griffith because, I mean, when films started, you got to remember they were those one-reelers where it'd just be like one camera shot, a train coming at you, you know?
Yeah, or the guy sneezing or the guy shooting at the camera, yeah.
Right. I mean, this was the early days. I mean, they had no idea what this stuff was going to turn into
right.
And what, you know, the power that it would later present. But I think what D.W. Griffith was able to do is he was the first one to establish a language or, dare I say, a type of film grammar that would become the language of every movie made after that. I mean, basically, we are making movies the way Griffith decided they were going to be made.
Now, hold on, before we go any further. That's a word that's a term you've used a lot in the Hollywood Saloon, and I like to get a real hardcore, concrete definition, Jansen definition of film grammar. Tell me
film
what that
grammar,
is.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think it, you know, I try and relate it to, you know, like in writers, you know, there's like a writer's prose they have, you know.
Right.
And I think among musicians that are certainly well attuned in their craft, you know, mm-hmm. they don't have to be famous. They can just be great players. Other musicians recognize that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's a musician's prose or any type of, you know, something you could put into words. But it's just something to where you've been at your craft for, say, 20 years. And I think it was McTiernan that I got the whole film prose with, and he had a quote.
It takes 20 years to get a film prose style. It's funny, writers respect each other for that. A writer will respect another writer for having acquired a prose style. And I'm not sure filmmakers, they don't talk about it yet or think about it that way. That, in a way, a brother filmmaker or sister filmmaker should be respected for simply having acquired a film style, film prose style. That means that just like with a prose writer, that person has spent a particular number of lonely, hard hours at a typewriter. If somebody acquires a cinema prose style, it means they spent a particular number of hard years trying to learn how the damn thing goes together.
After a while, you can see it among other directors where some that don't have that same type of talent don't have it. You know what I mean? Why are some things vanilla plain and other things that are using the exact same camera, the exact same type of lights, the exact same tools, but yet can create something better? It's in music, you know?
That's
unique. The Beatles have a prose and a style, but it's completely different from Led Zeppelin's. And they're both great. You know what I mean? They both achieve their level of musical perfection and what they did, but they're two types of music grammar, if you will. So going back to Griffith, the first time he decided to go to a close-up, he was creating a sense of style. Mm-hmm. He was taking us from a wide and going in close. He was telling us, you're going to look at this because this is more important now. And then using the iris shot, zooming into something and then pulling off of the iris. That's a sense of style. It's drawing your eye to something and then getting to a wide shot. And then cross-cutting. The first time you cross-cut from two levels of action or putting the camera on a car and just tracking and following someone, you know, having the first dolly shot or, you know, moving camera shot, and certainly creating the big first, what, 2.5 hour, 3 hour epic mm-hmm. with Birth of a Nation. And then, you know, taking all your profits from Birth of a Nation and making what is my favorite film of his, and one of my all-time favorite films is Intolerance, mm-hmm. which I just still think is just, it's a film class in itself. You know, it breaks almost every convention that was even invented by Griffith the first time around, but he's telling four parallel stories, all cross-cut within each other, all building up in rhythms to their eventual climaxes in different complete eras. And it's just, it's huge, and it he took an elevator and he gutted the elevator and he put this camera on it so he could get the big old first crane shot just on this Babylon scene where he had thousands of extras. Mm-hmm. Not computer-generated extras, not dissolve-ins of other, you know, extras. I mean the real thing. And it's just, oh, I mean, that's style in a way, because it's just, it's big and it's presentational. And it would set a precedence that would move on through every epic we ever saw on the big screen that would come after that. And, you know, that would carry on to be a Hollywood tradition in terms of the big shots and... That could be a considered another form of style, doing something bigger than television.
Now, hold on. Before you move forward, let me dive in here because I want to piece together what you're telling me. Using Griffith as an example, okay, what basically you're telling me is that style, I liked the way that you used the play metaphor, saying that, you know, you don't really have control over what you look at, okay? The viewer has control of where he looks, obviously, because there's no shot, right? But within style says this person, the director, Griffith or whomever, tells you what you have to look at. He says you're going to look through my eye, and when you look through my eye, you're going to see this, and I'm going to direct you on how that comes about. And that's really the first time that you get into the director as someone who has.
Is an authorship over the motion picture.
Right.
Martin Scorsese has a great quote about this. And Scorsese is very upfront about whenever he borrows other shots from other films. He's constantly referencing other shots during the making of Taxi Driver. And there's that famous shot of Travis Bickle walking down the street. Okay, and then it dissolves and it kind of moves into like a medium shot. And he's taking a drink or something. How many times have you seen that where the camera doesn't move, but the character, you know, moves closer into the dissolve?
Sure.
How many times? 100? 500? All the time.
Right.
But in Taxi Driver, it really stood out. And I don't recall seeing that technique again until he used it again in After Hours. Right. And then he did it again in Last Temptation. I used to think that was a Scorsese little brushstroke because I didn't see it a lot in other directors' films. But to hear him talk about, oh, no, that was Shane.
Borrowing that dissolve effect from George Stevens' film Shane. It's a scene where Jack Palance walks into the bar. And the camera's at a very low angle. And he approaches towards the camera and then dissolves to a much tighter shot of his boots as they go past the frame. I always found it to be fascinating. I used it there.
You know, when the camera's going into the glass of Alka-Seltzer and you see all those bubbles, you know, it's a fantastic shot. You know, it's the kind of things where movies don't do. It lingers, you know. It's getting into different sort of psyche and perspective.
I always like that scene in One or Two Things I Know About Her, a Godard picture in which she looks at a coffee cup and it kind of moves into the top of the cup and into the coffee and the bubbles in the coffee give the impression of space, the Milky Way almost. I guess it's New York. This is a New York version. But we tried to not keep the cutting of the film in straight narrative. The visual images, after he gets out of the cab up earlier, he takes the rag in his hand, then it jump cuts and he's cleaning up the back seat. And that was the idea, to try to keep disorienting the sense of anxiety and uneasiness that we wanted to give the audience.
Him talking about the Mario Bava camera moves, and that's why he was moving in on things.
Now, the moves for Travis's paranoia, camera moves, are in direct line with the tradition of the horror film. The moves by, camera moves by Mario Bava in the Italian films in the 60s. Not that you sit down and say, hey, let's do the moves from a horror film, but somehow from my subconscious, they're interpreted that way on paper. Again, all these shots are scripted. All these moves have been thought of way beforehand. Otherwise, there's no way to do this picture for $1.3 million in 1975.
I mean, this is all style and a type of film grammar that is Scorsese's film grammar. But even he acknowledges that he's taking from the history of cinema and pouring it all through his own filter, his own eye of the way he sees things. And then it spits out, and that's the film.
Okay, so I think I'm getting a point of what you're saying here. With style and how it's defined through the director's eye. That's great. Now, don't tell me this, and I may be totally off base here, but, I mean, is this kind of style what would basically set up the whole system where they talk about auteur?
Well, I mean, I guess, I mean, you go back to, you know, one of the first you could claim like that would be Orson Welles, right?
Right.
And isn't he kind of the poster boy for us all?
You know, he's like all four faces of Mount Rushmore for independent thinking filmmakers. I mean, he encompasses it all. You can't really escape his shadow.
But I've never belonged to the Hollywood establishment. My goodness, the first contract I had when I came out here to this town was a kind of a defiance of everything that was established in the Hollywood industrial system.
Nobody comes on the set, and nobody gets to look at the rushes, nothing. You just make the picture, and that's it.
And I only got that contract because I didn't really want to make movies. I thought if I asked for something impossible, they'd leave me alone.
We've talked about in other shows, he wasn't in a position to know any better. So no one told him he couldn't do what he was doing. And he had Greg Tolan as a cinematographer. And it's worth noting that when you look at the credit card on Citizen Kane, it says directed by Orson Welles, you know, photographed by Greg Tolan. It's on the same card.
Mm-hmm.
When was the last time you saw that in a movie?
Right. Well,
ever.
obviously, Welles felt strongly
exactly
enough to do that.
A combination of the style that Tolan was bringing through Welles's filter and how they worked together. And I mean, that film is still a blueprint for modern motion pictures today.
Right.
And I think it carries over. I mean, you had, you know, the German directors like Fritz Lang. I mean, think of Metropolis, you
sure,
know.
Sure.
It's a beautiful silent film, but I just remember the camera shot that was on that trapeze. That always impressed me, that camera movement, how wild it was and how it mm-hmm. swooped on down. You know, for someone used to watching television and just, you know, static filmmaking, you see shots like that and, God, is it a dirty word to say the expressiveness of the shot, you know, the visceralness of it and just the way it makes you feel?
Well, I think one of the most important things when you think about camera movement in that kind of style back then, see, that's the deal. You have to put it in context and look at it through those eyes. If you look at it through today's eyes, it's meaningless. It means nothing. But, I mean, when you put it into that context and you look at it, you know, from in their perspective, that's when it becomes amazing and almost magic, if you will, because it's like people are saying, okay, I don't quite understand this. I mean, you remember, like we said earlier, the whole deal with the, you know, when they were projecting film for the first time and people, like, they did the train coming at the camera mm-hmm. and it's like, you know, as it got closer, people got scared. Is it going to come through that wall?
Right.
You know what I mean? It would be like a caveman, you know, all of a sudden you give him a 60 inch plasma screen. It'd be like, whoa, you know, I don't know what this means.
Right.
And I think that's what you're talking about here is that when you put it in that kind of context, then it becomes huge. And especially Griffith. I mean, where the hell did he pull that from?
Yeah. I mean, just someone like, you know, with all the, I remember just all those dark shadows, you mm-hmm. know, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, those Dutch angles, you
right.
know, things
sure.
that, I mean, really every sense of style we talk about in this show almost becomes cliche later on because of the overuse. And I think that's kind of where you find your certain watermarks in cinematic history is when you find a type of director that creates a style that is so imitated that sort of almost dilutes itself. You know what I mean? It's like how many times until it loses its original intent?
Well, sure.
It becomes parody almost.
Well, and it's the only way that you can really watch older films. You can't look at older films with today's vision because back then, like I said, if you have to look at it in context. Mm-hmm. You have to look at it as they looked at it, and then it brings meaning, and then you can see how stylistic it is. But if you don't, and you look at through, you know, today's Michael Bay eyes, you're going to say, oh, ho-hum, I'm bored. I didn't, what's so exciting about that? Well, you have to look at what it did at the time.
When you're looking at, you got to look at everything. You got to look at the content. You got to look at the fact that when it was made and the story they're trying to tell, and does it work as a film? I mean, you got to remember, films, sometimes dialogue is the worst thing in films. You know,
yeah.
You don't even need it. A lot of films, the best films and the best sequences in them often don't even have dialogue.
Right.
It's just how they express themselves with the camera. That's why I love watching Griffith's films. And I mean, I think the silent films get a lot of things right, more right than a lot of the talkies do, because they can do it without all this excessive baggage of dialogue and dialogue is cliche. Right. So no matter what, you're trapped. It's a terror to try and sit at a blank piece of paper or a blank roll of film and try and think you're going to do something new, that you're going to create a new style today. We're all borrowing. I mean, that's just,
sure.
We're all filters. It's all going to be about what your influences are and how you fuse together. And also, I think most importantly, what's your material and what style are you bringing to it and why? And this is the question that'll come up is, I don't think people have answers for their whys anymore in their style.
Right.
I think Scorsese can answer you a why on every camera move and every cut in every single one of his films. But I'd say 80% of the films I see today, there'd be no rhyme or reason for a lot of the cutting. And some of it can just be intrusive to where, man, you got a great shot. You know, hold it.
Sometimes a cutting style is effective inside of a movie to shake you up and rattle your soul, but consistently to have that style pounding away at you like a metronome on high speed for 2.5 hours is a little bit, at least for me, maybe I'm just getting old, but it's a little bit debilitating. Now, it doesn't bother my kids, because my kids were raised on 30-second commercials and on MTV and VH1, and they were raised on video games.
The thing that comes to mind for me that just popped in my head all of a sudden is, think about Jaws on the beach, you know, and you know what I'm talking about, the reverse, well, you know, you and I call it the explosion shot. What is
right.
it, the reverse, whatever they call it. But
reverse zoom.
The reverse zoom, you know, that Hitchcock really kind of invented and brought forth. And, you know, there was a reason. It wasn't just to look cool. It was to show you the complete and utter, you know, powerlessness that Chief Brody had, you know, when he heard, oh, there's a shark, you know?
It's the kind of thing you did once in a movie. You didn't ever
right.
overuse it, and you didn't ever waste it, like of an opening shot of him getting out of bed or something. You held it, you used it as like the one firecracker you had to go off and boom. And, you know, it's a cinematic technique. Remember Soderbergh when he used it for a sex scene in Sex Lies, you know?
Yeah.
He even talks about it in the book. The crew gave him a hard time for the big reverse zoom shot. Ooh, the arty director, you know?
Yeah.
You got to trust that the reason you're doing it, because you know that you're going to put the right piece of music and it's going to cut together and set the right mood for the cinematic sort of montage or whatever you're trying effect you're trying to get.
Well, the point is that you're trying to elicit a particular response. And that's what you use the tools of, I hate to say cinema, the tools of filmmaking to use. And I mm-hmm. think that, you know, if style is important and each director is bringing his style, his film grammar to a film, then we are looking at films through their eyes. And the point, I think what we're trying to say and that you're trying to say here is that, you know, it needs to, there needs to be something behind it, because if it's just hollow and it's just a nifty shot, then it becomes porn almost. You know what I mean? It has no value to it other than, look at this nifty shot, you know, whereas in the past someone used it to elicit a particular response. But now in these days, and we'll get to this later on in the show, it is used more as a tool to excite, as a neato nifty shot to accentuate the action, rather than some sort of,
or it's covering up the lack thereof.
Exactly. It's like, let's just, you do a bunch of fancy stuff, and it'll have no meaning and no reason.
It's a good sleight of hand, right?
But it'll look cool, and a bunch of things will blow up, so.
Mm. What I'm afraid of is the tendency for everything to go by quickly. And I'm afraid of what it does to the culture. A sense of consuming something and throwing it away, as opposed to being enveloped with something. Taking the time to see and experience time in a different way.
I think it's perfect you mentioned Hitchcock, because, I mean, he's one of our more famous film stylists, so much so he was on his own posters.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of, I mean, what was the last director you saw on a movie poster?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Presenting his films in that kind of way. But, I mean, you knew a Hitchcock film. You could right. be flipping the stations and you watching something, and it was just, it was his cuts, it was the way he moved the camera, mm-hmm. it was his shot selections, everything was precision and controlled. And I think it was because he was a very strong proponent of the storyboard process.
Right.
Of, he figured out his film before he made it. He said, that will be a wide shot, and then that will hold for this long, and then on that line we're going to cut to this medium shot, and then mm-hmm. on this line we're going to cut to that, and he shot what he needed.
Right.
That's why he was often bored when he got to the set, because he had already made the movie.
Right.
And, you know, he's famously has called actors, you know, cattle and whatnot. But in his perspective, in his mind, he'd already made the movie. So the laborious part of shooting it was boring to him. And I'm sure just making all the actors do something that he had already been through in his head, you know,
probably
lost its allure after 50 films or something, you know. But, you know, as a stylist, that's important. And the storyboarding would set a standard that still is being practiced today of figuring out so everybody knows what they're going to do. And Terry Gilliam had something very interesting to say about this.
I used to have it all storyboarded and then insist the actors try to fit into my storyboards, which, yeah, it works, but it's also limiting. And over the years, it's been more interesting to let the actors dictate and concentrate on that. Maybe, and I'm not sure if the films are looking as graphic as they used to, because the actors are taking over more, not this precise kind of image that I was obsessed with before. It's a happy trade-off, because I think particularly now that so many films are so carefully designed and planned, and since everybody's going down that road, I'll take another path.
But, you know, going back to where we were in the 60s, I mean, a director that you and I just are in love with,
worship,
that is pure style, that is probably responsible for us talking right here at this moment, is Sergio Leone.
Oh, yes.
And he never used storyboards. This man thought the film up in his head, went out with a camera, set up the first shot. He got that shot, and then he set up the second shot, or the second cut. Then he got that shot, then he set up the third cut, and then he got that shot, and he made his movies that way. They were all in his head, and he could just shoot linear and just get the cuts he needed and put together the movie.
Right.
And they're pure Leone in terms of the choices he makes. They're extreme choices. The close-up of the eyes and the gun and the widescreen frame and the long, long shots and the long pauses. He's using time to lure you in, to manipulate you. And I think that's a form of style, too.
Oh, yeah, and that's the worst thing about Leone is many other people. It was just, you know, I'm gonna bite this Leone style, you know, and now it's parody with the whole eye, gun, you know.
Imagine you're going to shoot a shootout scene, and you're going to say, okay, how am I going to shoot it? And the first thing you start thinking of is other ones you've seen before.
Sure.
What comes to mind? Well, maybe I need to get a close-up of the hand going down to the gun, you know. I better get the one from the other guy, too. Well, maybe I better get a medium, you know, and then suddenly, without even thinking about it, you're doing Leone.
Well, I mean, he is the ultimate author of the gunfight, you know, that people have put into their heads. If you get two people, stand them, you know, 20 feet apart from each other, facing each other with guns, you don't think anything but a Sergio Leone gun duel, you know, and you start thinking of the Ennio Morricone, and the first thing you want to do is go, bam, right cut to those eyes. That's amazing, because what he has done, he created, it's the standard.
Isn't that a language, though, in itself, like music?
Sure.
Watching his editing? Even if you turned off the music of his movies, just watch the shots in the editing. There's a beautiful music to his shots and editing as well.
Well, and you know, I mean, they're long, they're flowing, they sometimes move, you know, when he's trying to show scope. And I think, obviously, he's got a photographer's eye. I mean, you know, has anyone ever framed a shot more perfectly and more beautifully?
Every shot.
Every
single
shot.
There's, like, no throwaways. He doesn't, like, just ever, oh, well, I'll just settle. It's, like, it's precise.
Well, and that's the thing that has hurt us, is that that's become our standard. And when we see things like, you know, cut to the modern day, when you got all this shaky cam stuff that's trying to elicit a response, you know, are we supposed to believe that someone's, you know, holding, someone's filming this and that makes it real world and they've got the shakes or something? And it's just so retarded compared to this grandiose, beautiful, you know, lockdown camera of Leone that really has set the stage. And when you go back to that and that becomes your base, it's hard to watch this other stuff. Not that it's not good, not that it's not interesting, but I think the thing is that it sets the standard. And there's not a lot of people who are really film buffs, you know, that would argue that. Is that more than anything, Sergio brought to the game was this incredible vista shots. That's just hard to be topped.
And a sense of rhythm, to his editing.
Oh, sure.
That would be very influential, that would continue through the 60s. Because you got to think, you know, Richard Lester, Hard Day's Night.
Right.
I mean, think about, I mean, that isn't that kind of the invention of MTV almost?
Oh, right definitely. There? Sure.
I mean, just montages of music and a lot of cuts. And obviously, the explosion of the French New Wave. And, you know, you have the big names, you know, the Godard and Antonioni and Truffaut. But the moment Godard did a jump cut, you know?
Right.
And he wasn't the first one. I mean, let's zip right back on in time, right on down to the letter E for Eisenstein.
The crazy Russians start fucking around with images, all right, and juxtaposing them and creating different emotional effects.
They took these films out in the middle of the farmlands and showed it to the farmers and the peasants. They began to understand that they could get a certain emotional and psychological effect by a certain type of cutting from one image to the next. And that became a manipulation of what the audience was feeling, you know?
Yeah.
Sergei.
Cut back,
look at
back,
his
forth,
montage.
Back, forth. Yeah, that stuff's amazing to look at.
I mean, even today, look at it.
Right.
It's brilliant. It holds up.
That's the thing. It holds up today. And I think more than anything, it's like radical for even today. It's like Tony Scott on speed, you know?
And these guys were doing it the hard way. They were taking pieces of film and going, six frames, stop, new piece for six frames, stop, you know, glue,
right,
tape, whatever. And, I mean, that's just a discipline when you're talking about cutting on actual film.
Eisenstein is the first real director. He killed himself in his staging, and he killed himself with his camera work and everything, but it was all at the service of the scissors. Every little single solitary bit of it. For a writer, it's a word, all right? For a composer or a musician, it's a note, all right? For an editor and a filmmaker, it's the frames, all right? And you know, the one frame off or two frames added or two frames less is the difference between a sour note and a sweet note. It's the difference between clunky, clumsy crap, all right, and orgasmic rhythm.
Right.
We will get to digital editing. We'll throw that bone in the air a little bit later. But for right now, we're going old school. All of these projects we're talking about, Leone and all these guys, well, Leone's probably cutting a lot of stuff in the camera now that I think about it, you know?
Wow.
He's so precise, he could probably get away with some free cuts right there in the camera. But, I mean, they're having to do it the hard way. And that's why it took a year to edit a movie or longer. Because you were just going through reel and reel and looking for those shots. And the best directors had it all in their head anyway. So it was just spending the hour to find that 5-second cutaway that, you know, you want to put in there.
Right.
You know, or spending 10 hours trying to find that shot.
Right.
You and I had a chance to come from that school. We started there. We'll never go back. We ran as far away as we could to those digital editing machines when they became available.
Yeah, of
but,
course.
But the principles, we've said before, certainly dictate not only how we see films, because once you're an editor and you cut film, you can never look at editing the same way again, because you know what goes into it. You know
right.
the discipline and the choices you make. It will change the way you look at film forever.
Right. Well, yeah, I agree. And the editing, I mean, that's a powerful thing. I mean, think about jump forward to you know, the next master that we love, you know, Mr. Sam Peckinpah.
Well, you know, we know it's a new sound effect called Echo Chamber.
I know, it's like, if you guys talk about Michael Mann, Sam Peckinpah, Sergio Leone again.
That damn Peckinpah again. But at least now people can go out and get that Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid and watch that opening sequence, and at least they'll know.
There's
they'll
style.
Have a reference.
There's
and
style.
I'm talking the extended disc 2. Do not put in disc 1. You're not going to be
no.
seeing what I'm talking about here.
Your DVD will explode if you put that one in.
I mean, Martin Scorsese says it best about Sam Peckinpah.
I mean, the man who did Violence in Slow Motion has a patent on it. Is Sam Peckinpah, so you don't mess around with that. What's the point? Now, the only way you have to do it is to do it for another effect or to literally let the audience see what is going on. Now, the reality, I would slow down into slow motion. You know, it's sometimes it's the way, let's say, something would happen to you, let's say, and you'd be in a conversation with someone, and as you're saying something, and something's being said to you which is highly unpleasant or something really wonderful, you remember looking at what the person was doing, whether it was playing with a pencil in her hand or playing with a glass, And whenever you remember the conversation, the first image that comes back to me, for example, is my hand in the glass. What I felt when she said that or he said that. So that would be the shot I would take. And I do that in slow motion. Because it sort of burns in your memory. I started playing around with it a lot in Mean Streets, where natural, very, very simple, simple gestures were done in slow motion. Lighting of a cigarette, taking a drink, rather than the violence in slow motion. Usually in my movies, when violence is in slow motion, it's because you can't see it otherwise. You can't see the punch, or you can't see the knife going in. You know what I'm saying? We have to slow it down. We have to speed up the film, slow down the image, so that you can see the action. And Raging Bull is a perfect example of that. We didn't necessarily want to do constantly slow motion. We had no choice at certain times. The slow motion was more important when he'd move away from the opponent and lift his trunks up as he was doing so, you know, and get back into the corner. That's in slow motion, I thought, in some cases. That's interesting, those gestures that stick out in your mind if you're watching the fight, you know, and you see, oh, boy, that guy moved around, or see what he did with his hands or his feet. Look at his foot action, you know, and do that in slow motion. That's interesting.
When Scorsese bows down to Peckinpah, you know who you're dealing with here. This ain't no fly by night. This is a guy who drank hard. No, he drank harder.
So the car pulls right up. And if you're off at a distance, you see an empty chair in the middle of a set. Now, the car whips in, and you have all this attendant dust, and it whips out. But there's someone now seated in the chair. Sam, like a snake, just slithered out and sat in the chair. And he'd sit for 10 minutes. 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and everybody would say, who didn't know Sam, look at him. He's creating. He's deciding what marvel. Actually, what he's trying to do is to get his heart started because he was up all night again, and he's waiting for his B1 shot. And the doctor would show up about 15 minutes later, give him 50,000 units of vitamin E, and now he's up and going. And they thought he created as he sat there. But again, if you knew Sam, he knew every shot in every sequence a year before the time came to shoot it.
Memo to Tony Lawson, editor of Cross of Iron, regarding assembly of final sequence. End sequence. Take it two steps further. Start with the end sequence two reels earlier. Talk to editor about opticals and desaturation. See him by end of next week. Freeze frames. With frozen frame, I want action. A reprise and flashback in context with growing progression. We'll take it one step further. Reprise, but not from the film and not from the horror stories. Reprise sound. Flashback in sound. Talk to Murray. Start with ending. Freeze frame. Reprise it. Begin at beginning. Superimpose movement and the frozen frame that overlaps of two different angles of frozen frame and go into action. Then go into previous conception of the progression of the war, but make it simple. Angle of a guy turning like this, and freeze. In that frozen frame, he looks the other way. So I have two different angles at what he sees. Freeze frame, then superimpose next turning. Do not want to use any atrocities except this one photo. Start.
And it's not that every film he made was a masterpiece, and we've talked about that. You know, go back to our first Wall Hero show.
Yeah.
But you're right. I am so addicted to Peckinpah's editing. Peckinpah knew his shots, and he knew rhythm, and he knew montage. And, I mean, I don't know if it was maybe the freedom of the French New Wave that opened him up between Major Dundee, Ride the High Country, and then suddenly this explosion called The Wild Bunch.
Everything changed.
And
right.
Everything
film
changes.
Was changed.
Everything.
Film was changed forever.
Action movies changed forever.
For a guy to come out of a trailer with his headband on and create that whole world of illusion, which is what he could do, there aren't too many guys that can do that. The people that can't do it, the money men, who have to hitch a ride with you, have got to hate you. You can fly and they can't. And he didn't disguise his contempt for them.
There are not really many directors who make motion pictures anymore. They are talented. They shoot schedules. But when they get through, what you basically have is an enlarged television show. Sam had figured out, and I think rightly so, that if you're going to have a motion picture, you must maintain control over everything.
Yeah.
Westerns change. The way we ever will look at montage and rhythm and well, dare I say, violence.
Well, I think the word that you said that is real strong here is rhythm. And I think that that's what you have to look at Peckinpah. So many times people think that Peckinpah is just about slow motion and blood packs, and that's really not the case. It really is slow motion, blood packs, and rhythmic editing is what you're looking at.
Extreme rhythmic editing. Right. Back to Eisenstein, almost. Certainly there's an influence there. You have to draw the pool.
I think there's one person who's making a picture, and that person has to be the director. Producers are often only administrators, and they're too interested in defending their own prerogatives. I've got a temper, and I can't stand stupidity, so I'm always at war with these cats. I want control of everything, from the script to the cutting room. And if I don't get what I want from people, I put them on the bus. The trouble with producers is you can't do that to them. Everybody else comes and goes in a picture, but the producer stays to the end. The best producer is a guy who'll let you make your own movie. There aren't many around.
Look at the way that Peckinpah moved to the shot. Remember one of the rules in the beginning of was cut on the action. And you know how powerful that is to cut on the action. Don't let the guy move his hand, and then once it's at his side, then cut. Cut on the movement. As his hand is moving, then cut. And then cut to a shot where he's moving previous. You know, if you watch Peckinpah, the shots melt together from one to the next. There's no jump cut unless he specifically is looking for a jump cut. But what I'm talking about is within his action, let's go to the final battle in Wild Bunch, of course. But
After the
greatest walk in film history. But what I'm talking about is obviously the fluidness of action from one to the next. And he's shooting everything at, 68 frames a second or 64 or whatever it is.
And mixing it with 48. Mixing it with 120.
Right. He's mixing these film speeds. It's cutting through the shot. And then he's crisscrossing between two different events, cross-cutting. And that's the thing. And the thing that no one has still yet bit on very well, because they just don't have the tools to do it, the film grammar, if you will. See, that's the point. This is the thing that's amazing about Peckinpah. I've seen people try to do it before. They try to say, I'm going to bite Peckinpah. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to try to steal his film grammar and make something that's in the vibe of his. Well, not very many people have done it. I've seen a few people try it, and I've seen some people maybe on flashes of instant come close, but still no one's done it to the regular rhythm that he did it. Obviously you got Wild Bunch, but then go to Cross of Iron, for the love of God. That's just a style explosion, and the rhythmic editing that flows through that, all the way through. And what he's done is he's created that rhythm that is his, and it's his style, and it defines who he is as a director. When we think about Sam Peckinpah, you don't think about Convoy, okay? You don't think about The Killer Elite, which, you would think that The Killer Elite, with all the action in it, you would think that it would be a good one, but nah.
No.
It was just a quickie, I think. But the point is that...
No, you go, like you said, you go back to Cross of Iron. That's where you want to land.
And you see flourishes of it, like in... you get it in The Getaway.
There's some really good sequences. In fact, Getaway, I love... Think about the opening of Getaway, just the montage when he's in prison and you hear that machine, ka-chung, ka-chung, ka-chung.
Yeah.
And then, he crumples, he's building the little popsicle stick house, and then he crumples it, and then, the vision of the guy jumping in the water, just... You're seeing, like, six or seven different timelines being compressed together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is what Peckinpah figured out as a way to compress time through this montage and rhythm of editing and create this sort of uniqueness. Nobody else was doing it, and nobody can do it as well since. Like you said, they touch on it. It's like Led Zeppelin. You can try and imitate it, but Led Zeppelin was four guys with different tastes in music who came together to create one music. And you can imitate it, but it'll never be like its original source, because it's not coming from the original well. Because even if you did imitate it, Gus Van Sant, Psycho, frame by frame, you would just be ridiculed for being an imitator. You're not an originator, you just copied Peckinpah. And if that's what you were trying to do, then so be it. But you would hope that... I mean, you see guys out there, when you see that Running Scared, Wayne Kramer's film, obviously he's got all this film grammar built up inside of him, you know, shots and ideas and things that he'd wanted to get out. And he found a type of script that he could sort of unleash all this on. It's completely different than his other movie that he did, The Cooler. You know, I saw it as just in a way to express all of this style in there. And you see that with a lot of modern directors today. Mm-hmm. But so much of it you can trace back to the works of, you know, the directors that we are talking about, because these are our teachers in a lot of ways.
Sure.
It's this, they're the music that we liked the best, that we wanted to rewind and watch again and rewind and watch again and rewind and watch again.
I still can't watch Peckinpah without having a rewind, without having a remote next to me. And to me, the thing is that I always compare, because you have to have a criteria. Okay. And when I see, I always compare back to those standards. And so when I see someone going for it and miss the mark, I just want to throw monkey shit at him. Okay. This is part of the problem that I have with Rodriguez. It's because I see him so hard wanting to try to do that and just falling short. He'll have a couple of good shots where I'll go, hey, the way that those guys picked up that table three times, I'm with you, buddy. I'm with you on that. Mm-hmm. You know? But then later on, it'll just be like, he went too far. Or maybe in an effort to stick out and not be so like this.
His sensibilities are just different. He's coming from a more fun, loose,
right,
you know, maybe parody-ish, you know, cartoony, Looney Tunes kind of perspective.
Well, but I think
I guess,
the thing is that the standard was set.
He makes movies.
Well, the standard was set with something like Peckinpah, and it moved forward to people like, you know, Martin Scorsese.
I mean, that's the name. After Scorsese, film grammar would change. What was unique that he was doing, and I mean, I think about that one in Taxi Driver of De Niro, you know, listen, you fuckers.
Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. Here is a man who would not take it anymore, who would not let... Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. Here is a man who would not take it anymore.
Yeah.
That was breaking. That was like bringing in bad language or something into an elegant conversation known as editing in a movie. Scorsese didn't care. He knew what he was doing. He was influenced by the filmmakers who dared to say, no rules. The film needs it. Psychologically, I could justify the cut. I know why I'm doing it, and I want it in there.
Right.
And he would do that for all of his shots, and I think we would become enamored by them.
You know, Marty has an enormous visual sense and had strong ideas and strong images in his head. You know, he did outrageous things. The shot where Robert De Niro goes this way and the camera goes that way and shows all his world that he experiences and then comes back and finds him. The crew were sort of shocked by it. You know, crews are very conservative in a curious way. And they made hundreds of shots following somebody. But the idea of letting him go that way and the camera go that way almost offended their sensibilities. After a while, they got used to that because they realized it was Marty. But none of them had worked with Marty before. And the idea of doing it was, I remember that it was, that was the biggest thing I remember about it was how shocking it was to the crew and how it made them nervous. The movie's full of that. Marty thinking of something that nobody ever done. He's talking on the telephone and then the camera goes that way and just shows this empty hall. It's full of that stuff.
When I thought of that shot, it gave it presented to me how the style of the picture would be, where the moves would be, the camera moves would seem, if I could really put it in words, I wouldn't have had to put it on film. The idea is that there's a sense, again, of anxiety, a sense of uneasiness of the camera tracking to an empty hall. Is that his soul? Is that his, you know, whatever you want to think of it, the emptiness he's feeling in his heart or whatever? Or are we about to reveal something is there about to be an explosion? Is something terrible going to happen in the hall? You know, it was the idea of keeping the audience off balance all the time. And that was the piece. All the other shots came from that concept that's in that shot right now. And it just turned out to be one of the last shots we took, but it was the first one I thought of.
You know, he would move from, you know, that and, of course, Raging Bull, but then look what he does with King of Comedy. Completely throws away all of that film grammar, and he shoots it completely static, almost, with these big old wide shots, those long, long takes. And I loved it, you know, still love it. And it's stylized in a different way.
Well, think about this. This is the style in King of Comedy. You have to understand who Rupert Pupkin is. And he is a man without style. He is a man without talent. Mm-hmm. And that's the gist of the show. And it's all about television. Mm-hmm. And him getting basically on, you know, the Jerry Langford show. So that's the style. He's underneath Rupert Pupkin is the style that's carrying the film. It's basically the style of Rupert Pupkin. Same thing with Taxi Driver. You're seeing Travis Bickle's crazy head.
Exactly. And you're seeing a filmmaker who's saying, okay, just because I dolly into somebody, you know what I mean, or I attach the camera to Harvey Keitel as he walks through the club, it doesn't mean I'm going to do it in every one of my movies.
Sure, of course.
You know, these are elements that I use for those projects. It also means that I can adopt what is necessary. Look what he did with New York, New York. He shot it in 1.66, and he tried to go for those artificial backgrounds. He wanted all that artificiality, but he also wanted that sort of Ilya Kazan, John Cassavetes hard drama, too, in the acting scenes. And it was a big clash, and people didn't know what to make of it when it came out, because no one had ever tried to fuse that kind of those artificial and reality moments together.
Right.
But, you know, that's what I love about Scorsese is, you know, not only is he borrowing film grammar, he's inventing film grammar with his movies. And I think After Hours was almost a rebirth for him when he brought Michael Ballas in. And this is going to be the next stage you get, where a lot of European influence is coming over, where they didn't have Hollywood's rules. And McTiernan, actually, we go back to McTiernan, but he talks about a lot of problems he had on Die Hard.
I was particularly concerned with the sense of camera movement. Technically, it was, I suppose, my preoccupation at that time. I'd done a lot of it in Predator. I wanted to do a lot more here. So that was particularly why I'd hired Yanni on the bunt, because of the style of camera movement in The Fourth Man. And what I was trying to do was get an editor who's, because there used to be an awful lot of nostrums about what you could do and what you couldn't do. And particularly for a young filmmaker, you'd have, if the editor didn't agree, he'd start bad-mouthing you to the studio behind your back. Oh, this stuff doesn't cut very well. Because there used to be rules about, you know, that you can't cut a shot until the camera stops moving and all of this. I'd cut an awful lot of my own stuff, and I was quite happy cutting the cameras moving. It takes a particular style, but it can be done. And that's what I was particularly concerned about getting Frank Uriosti. And he was wonderfully supportive about cutting on movement. And we, between the two of us, sort of set up a research program of what can we do and what can't we do. And for quite a while I was shooting alternate takes of most shots, where I would shoot the move at a different speed so that Frank could cut, so that he could match the movement speed. Gradually we found it wasn't that necessary. I don't know, my own sense of timing got better or something, and we had to do less of it. But I think through the first half of this movie, I was shooting alternate speeds on dolly moves.
There wasn't a lot of moving camera in a lot of action movies at that time. Go back and watch 48 Hours. How many moving camera shots are in that movie? You can count them on one hand.
Right, you know? Exactly.
It was just they were shot differently back then. And I think there's a couple elements at work here. I mean, Scorsese is a big one because we all like him. And when you see something that's really cool, you often think, well, I think I'm going to move the camera like that for this shot. And then it gets adapted into the culture. You have the Steadicam, Garrett Brown, an explosion in moving camera for the history of cinema.
Right.
Now we can do shots that were not even conceivable before, unless you wanted it to shake and not look very good. Now it can glide in between, you know, the merry-go-round, each little, hobby horse, if you want. I mean, there was just limitless possibilities. And it took a little while, I think, to adapt in. You had the explosion of MTV, of course, which was a vehicle for all style.
Sure.
And there didn't have to be a rhyme or reason for it. It was just an excuse to use Lumicranes and Steadicams. First, you know, tape-to-tape editing, time code editing, and then eventually digital editing. But these were just excuses for you know, playing around with the toys and the tools.
All art is technology. That's the very nature of it. The artist is always bumping against that technology. And the advent of whether it's a new color of blue, whether it's a proscenium arch, whatever it is, it changes the way we work in that art form.
Well, MTV was just montage. I mean, that's all it was. I mean, the reason it became style was because it dictated nothing more than style. That's all you could give on MTV was style, because if you got 3 minutes to do something, You know, yeah, sure, there were some videos that tried to tell a story, but to me, those are the ones I was like, turn off, you know? Mm-hmm. I want to see the ones that's just heavy on style, and that's really all that that was. That's why it bit so hard from the style of films and changed how people saw, you know, movies in general. So they tried to project that kind of stuff onto the movies, and they said, hey, let's take that MTV style, which, I mean, how do you take 3 minutes and try to project that into a 90-minute movie? Well, I mean, I guess you can look at Stealth or something, you know, or anything by Rob Cohen. Well, but what I'm saying is that at that time, a lot of people say, well, MTV changed a lot of things. Well, it did, because it only had 3 minutes to sell you a product. And they're going to use the tools in any way they can. See, that's a lot of things that people don't think about, is that MTV is just a, you know, well, back then, not anymore, was 24 hours of commercials. And I still believe the music videos are commercials for music and for groups and Absolutely. That kind of stuff. They're not really products unto themselves.
That doesn't have to be a dirty word either, okay?
No, and that's fine. But I think that at the time, it became a powerful medium only because it could only rely on montage. And like you said, it was born in the 80s, the time of the montage.
Well, and you had this new 80s slick look. You know, the European directors of the Ridley Scott, well, the Scott brothers. You know,
Adrian Lyne.
You had Adrian Lyne and Alan Parker. So, you know, these guys were coming in and they were lighting things differently.
Sure,
you know, they were using filters in a way that, you know, films of the 70s weren't. Films of the 70s had a gritty, realistic look. That was the period of the 70s. But the 80s was all about this sort of Fox future gloss, you know, this high-tech sheen.
And
these shoulder pads in your jackets, you know, these vibrant colors. I mean, the 80s were this weird pop reaction to the 70s. You know, it's like the whole hippie culture was just wiped out, and it was all replaced by
the
sheen video surface.
It was the rebellion against the hippie culture, absolutely.
And, you know, I think the film certainly reflected that. There was a slick sheenness to it, to where, you know, you had the Bruckheimer Simpson glossy package.
Right.
And a lot of it was style over substance. And you know what? Audiences didn't care. They ate it up because they were just being assaulted on the screen. But what happened in the 80s, I think you get a lot of, is they were laying down the song first and then cutting the visuals to the beats.
Oh, of course. Well, and that's what's so funny is that, well, they obviously knew that they had to create a montage to put this song in, okay? I mean, that was part of the business deal, right? With, say, Simpson Bruckheimer in the beginning, is if Top Gun is going to have all these songs, to a certain extent, you have to have a segment of a montage where you're going to highlight this song, okay? And, you know, it could sometimes be for 30 seconds. It could sometimes be for the, you know, it was rarely the full song. But I think one of the neatest things that reflects that is think about the first Naked Gun movie, okay, and how they parodied it. Remember the first time they show a montage of Naked Gun? And
oh,
at the
yeah.
end of the song, the little MTV titles come up on there?
That was beautiful. Yeah.
That was so classic because that was the statement. The statement is that your attempt to insert montage for the purpose of selling a song has taken, you know, this film and just and made a joke out of it. And then parodying that was just classic, because that's obviously what was going on, like I said, in Top Gun, you know, in Beverly Hills Cop 2. I mean,
I just thought it's like a shortcut in storytelling. It's like, well, instead of really designing a really good scene, we'll just show the character emoting while riding their motorbike on a sunset, and we'll understand how they feel.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
You don't do that on the stage. You know, you don't do that in regular drama. You do that in, well, movies. It is cinematic language, and there's a great quote about, you know, Stanley Kubrick. He got so fascinated with these Nestle commercials in the 80s and, you know, these Michelob commercials, and, you know, he's saying, forget what they're selling, beer, and just look at them. In 30 seconds, you got these 8-frame cuts, and they're establishing these mini little stories and these characters and the showing of the nightlife, and he said, they're the most brilliant examples of film that I've seen lately. He was completely fascinated by it, just because they were using the form and the technique to do something different. And that was what the 30-second and a minute commercial offered for a lot of filmmakers to cut their teeth and,
well,
and
think about
techniques,
it. The
Ridley Scott included.
The techniques of filmmaking bled over into these other formats.
Mm-hmm.
It bled over into commercials. It bled over into music videos. I mean, it's obvious they're going to use those tools. It's really just a bag of tools that keeps getting bigger and bigger. It's like a belt. Mm-hmm. You know, you got that belt where you can put your hammer in and you can put your wrench in and you can just, you know, it hangs off your belt. And you go in and you reach in and you grab the one you need at any particular time, if it's slow motion, if it's rhythmic editing or whatever. And I think, obviously, that's what you're seeing, is that it got to the point where we had the innovators. You know, we've talked about those guys, Peckinpah, Orson Welles, Hitchcock, Scorsese, et cetera, et cetera, Leone. And what happened is that once all those tools were available and said, hey, I can do that, and of course there was the director explosion. It wasn't just that, you know, you had to be a film student who came out of USC and got a master's degree from NYU to be able to be a filmmaker, because you could work in commercials, you can work in music videos, you can work in industrials or whatever.
It did open up a lot of new avenues that were not
available. Well, that's the deal. And they made the tools available. Anyone who's, you know, intelligent, who's a film fan, who wants to work in the industry, can bite those tools and say, well, I'm going to use this. Even in my little crap-ass commercial, I've influenced by Peckinpah. I'm influenced by Scorsese. And so you'd have this commercial that was way above what it needed to be. Mm-hmm. Because people were interested and they wanted to play with the tools. And I think mm-hmm. that's the fascinating thing, is that's why you get a glut of styles, because the tools for the first time were available and because everybody is directing at this point.
Yeah. I just remember there was a point in the 80s where, well, when I was starting to get into Scorsese and starting to notice moving camera shots after The Shining and so forth, mm-hmm. that I started cataloging every time I saw a moving camera shot in movies, and I would remember them, you know, and I'd kind of study them and try and see how they worked. Oliver Stone was a director that kind of I remember keeping tabs on early on, because you go back and you look at Salvador and Platoon, uh-huh. and look at the grammar of those movies, and we're talking the same cinematographer, Robert Richardson, who plays a key role in Oliver Stone, what we know as, and also his editors, mm-hmm. which we'll get to. But, and then you get to Wall Street, and then you had this explosion of camera movement, remember? You're just swirling down all the aisles, all that steady cam that he was using, even so much in that elevator shot, whipping back and forth through the conversation.
Right, right.
You know, I remember hearing him on the commentary. He was talking about he wanted the camera to be like a shark. It was just always moving, boom, 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 boom. And I remember thinking, well, okay, at least he's trying to conceptualize the choices he's making.
Sure.
And then he would go even further when he would get to the doors and then explode in JFK, and then all the drugs and peyote and acid and mescaline, everything came together during Natural Born Killers.
We had one color image, four or five black and whites, and then a back to color. And we tinted this train. Wanted to set a sense of wackiness and surreality right off the bat.
When you had it,
so the black and white is what I guess you can call vertical cutting, just going vertically on the moment and creating an inner moment and an outer moment at the same time. There she was feeling something else. She was coming on to Mickey in between her color texture. She was black and white coming on to Mickey, and of course Juliet picks up on it right away. And but she's too cool to like make a point of it. She just says, fuck you, walks away. Green record, green key lime pie. Don't expect to understand every changeover. It plays off texture, instinct, deconstruction of reality.
I mean, that was just, that was ripping. That was the history of cinema in a bag right there. He was just throwing it all in. Every technique that had ever been done and a few new ones thrown in, you know.
But with a purpose.
With a purpose.
Because he's exploiting the same thing that you're talking about. You know, he's making a message about the brokenness of media and how it exploits and uses these techniques and will do anything to get ratings, you know, including taking serial killers and making them celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the message, is that that's why Natural Born Killers is one of my favorite films of all time, is because it uses the tools to poke fun of the medium. You know what I mean? It uses the tools of the medium to bankrupt the medium. And so it's a double, it's, you know, it's in layers going across here. And I think that's one of the most amazing points I've ever seen on film is because he's using it against himself, if you will, you know?
And I think in creating satire, you have to become
sure.
what you're satirizing.
Absolutely.
So you have to do that kind of thing.
Exactly.
If you're going to do it. I mean, that's a key ingredient.
Right.
But, you know, jumping back to Scorsese, I remember After Hours, I really had that movie had an impact on me in 1985 when I saw it, because I saw a lot of movies in 85, but I hadn't seen one that had that kind of camera movement, that opening shot, boom, right on down, right into Griffin Dunn. I was like, wow, I'm in this movie. When a character would stand up, the camera didn't pan up. It boomed up.
Right.
The camera stood up with a character, right. floated over, and then dropped down when another character sat down in the other chair. I was starting to notice shots like that and going, wow, that's interesting. It was expressive in a way I wasn't used to. And that's what kind of got me into studying Scorsese and why he was doing all these kind of things that were different. And I remember there was something with Michael Ballas, his cinematographer, you know, talking about there's a shot where Griffin Dunn's holding this flyer and Scorsese goes, I want to do it just like that shot in Marnie, you know? And Ballas is like, well, I don't know. I remember Marnie. I've seen it, but I don't remember what you're talking about. And he goes, oh, okay. Well, and then he goes out and gets the videotape and then cues up and can show Ballas how the camera's like, you know, right there on the arm and following things, so Ballas can set up the shot and get what Marty wanted. And I think that's kind of funny, of this cinematic encyclopedia that's in Scorsese's head that can explode at any time.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about 1,000 pieces going through his filter, it comes out Scorsese. And I thought After Hours was key because he talks about it. In King of Comedy, he was doing 6 setups a day.
Right.
And he had really slowed him down, and it was like a long shooting schedule, and it kind of like he had lost that thrust he had when he was a student filmmaker, like in Mean Streets. And with Ballas and After Hours, he was jumping up to 30 setups a day, up to 42, you know, at times, you know, knocking out all the shots, pre-planning everything on his own, you know, his own storyboards, or own little drawings. He just does shot sheets, you know, he just makes sure every single shot, because he's planned them all. He knows this camera move's going to cut to this close-up, will cut to that wide. I mean, it's all figured out, so he doesn't waste any time on the set. He knows what he's going to get. And the film they did together afterwards, The Color of Money, was just an orgasm in terms of style, camera movement, and technique for 1986.
Oh, yeah. As normal with Scorsese, especially After Hours, is that, you know, that movie is about running around at night and not knowing where you're going. I mean, his style always mirrored the plot and the structure of the story. And that's what's interesting because, you know, flash forward, man, to Age of Innocence.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to get those kind of shots in Age of Innocence because it would be inappropriate.
Well, and he talks about, you know, he looked at a lot of Hitchcock for After Hours. He wanted those kind of tension and that feel. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize it till I saw it many years later, but another key film was Orson Welles' The Trial.
Uh-huh.
You'll see After Hours all over The Trial. It's mm-hmm. great. And that's a great expressionistic film from Orson Welles. He's doing all kinds of interesting things, and it's in beautiful black and white. You cannot say enough about Welles' film grammar and how just explosive his experimentation was with technique and in effect. And I remember, I mean, studying Scorsese and Color Money, because the other film that I was really into in 86, and God, this one always comes up too, but Highlander was an explosion of style to my eyes as a moviegoer. And I saw a lot of movies back then, but when I saw Highlander, I saw things that was not common in feature films.
Right.
I mean, you know, just the amount of creativity in each shot and cut and so forth. Now, I won't say Mulcahy can justify every single cut in his film and every camera move and everything else. I do not believe that. But what I do believe is that he was able to look at the material and find a film language that he thought would be appropriate to give it the best visceral thrill for that action movie. And I think he succeeded.
Well, if anything, you're just seeing the example of putting the tools to use for nothing more than fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's not heavy. He's not trying to make a heavy statement. And, you know, if you're such a strict person and you say, well, it has to have meaning. I mean, I think I appreciate it when it has meaning. Sometimes it doesn't, and it's okay as long as the material is worthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, later on when you see something like Michael Bay, when he is just stealing all the tools and it's hollow and empty and we don't care. That's why we all walk away saying, God, you know, I saw a bunch of neato action, but why do I feel so empty and hollow? Well, it's because there's nothing behind it. It's just, you know, it's just like I said, it's just action porn, but not good action porn. You know, it's just like weak action porn. And that's the problem with him. But back to Mulcahy, I think that what he was doing was he was using it, but he was using it in a way that was not unlike his material. He knew he was making a popcorn movie, and so he put the tools to use for a popcorn movie, and it worked fine. Although I think it elevated it a little more with all the great, you know, transitions and stuff like that.
Well, that's what's interesting, because he'd been playing with transitions in Razorback. There's two or three really clever ones in it. But I think when he read Highlander, he just said, God, this is even better. This is better for my transitions, because he's moving through time periods. And because of the story's nonlinear structure, he brought a style to it that would embrace it and actually visually convey what, you know, was going on.
Well, hey, and let's not forget where Mulcahy came from. Mulcahy, before David Fincher entered the scene, was the king of music videos.
He did the first one, right?
Nobody could touch Russell Mulcahy, okay? He was the god of music videos. All those Duran Duran music videos, plus many, many, many more. I mean,
it's just you watch like something as simple as Rio. Every shot is interesting.
Right.
There's not a bland shot. Every single shot is either framed interesting, there's a bit of action in it, it moves, it has a color, there's just something to every shot is stylized in a way.
Right.
And when you bring that to a feature film that normally the old Hollywood rules are telling you, no, you don't impose your fingerprints on a movie. You get out of the way and just let the movie tell its story. And some of the greatest films of all time adhere to that.
Sure.
I'm saying, yes, that is a great way to use it. But other directors aren't interested in that. You know, they are interested in imposing their fingerprints. They want you to see this and that and that piece. And by doing that, they're saying that, you know, you can get five directors to direct this piece of material, and there'll be five different movies, but I think by mine, you'll find mine the most creative or interesting or something. You know, this is going to be the choice that I took. I took the rock and roll method instead of the classical music method.
Well, I think like I was saying, and like I've been saying, everyone has their own bag of tools they pulled from. You know what I mean? Even you and I have different bags of tools if we were going to direct films. And you're on your set and you're riffing. I mean, isn't that what Leone was doing if he didn't have storyboards? He was just saying, all right, okay, this is what I see next. Okay, this is what I see next. It doesn't matter if he can trace it back to where it came from. It's just such a part of him now, or you, or any director, that it becomes your bag of tools, because you took, you know, two parts Scorsese and mixed it in with three parts Peckinpah and one part Coppola. You know what I mean? And you mixed it, and then you came out with, you know, whoever. And I think that's what happens, and that's how new style is created today. And, you know, it can be diluted, whereas, you know, if you're on the sixth person down the rung, it's going to be weak. I mean, and that's part of what you're seeing with Michael Bay. It's just weak because he's using weak examples. But if you go back and you have the grammar and you're pulling from a smart source, an original source, then that's a different thing. You're bringing a bigger, larger, smarter, more intelligent tool. And, you know, so that I don't sound pretentious and stupid here, and maybe I do already, but I think my point is that there doesn't have to be rules. There doesn't have to be anything like that. And everything is... there's plenty of people that love what Michael Bay does. And I'm sorry I'm going into the Michael Bay rant, but I think that...
Oh, is this the rant part of the show?
I'm not ranting, because I think he stylistically he can make some beautiful shots. Absolutely, you know. But I think that it's just weakened. And there's people that are worse than
him. Well, there's a term that some people use, and Gilliam uses it. It's called derivative. And let me let Gilliam define it for you.
Well, what is a derivative? It's the kind of things that...
I've got him.
That, what's his name? Roland Emmerich is derivative.
Who's that?
He's the guy that made Day After Tomorrow and Godzilla. Because all of his shots derive from Steven Spielberg shots. They're all identical almost. So he's derivative. He doesn't make original films. He makes films that are like somebody else's thing. So if you're derivative, you're acting... It's like you acting like Nick Nolte. Oh. If you learned your acting skills and copied Nick Nolte, you'd be derivative. But in fact, you're original. It's the opposite of original.
There's another quote, too. Wasn't it Alfred Hitchcock that said, self-plagiarism is style?
Sure.
So Sergio Leone is plagiarizing himself because it's coming out of him. Thus, he creates a style.
Right.
And Scorsese's self-plagiarizing himself whenever he, you know, pushes a camera in on an object or something. He's done it in more than one movie, you know, in a sense. But
well, the point is that we're in a day and age where, like you said, everything that's been done basically has been done. And it's hard to be an innovator today. If you're an innovator today, boy, man, my hat's off to you.
Well, there's
that's
certain
an
innovative
thing.
Tools. You keep mentioning the tools. I mean, yeah, we're now slipping into the 90s. Suddenly, you get digital editing, you know. I guess we can thank George Lucas and Edit
George
Droid.
Lucas. Yeah, there you go. Make more fun of George Lucas, assholes.
Now you can edit what I call in 3D, which is you have a scene and you have people in the scene and you can cut those people out. You can move them around in the scene. You can go in for a close-up. You can go out. You can sort of direct the film in the editing room, which is, growing up as an editor, what I've always wanted to do.
Go ahead, make more fun.
Yeah, he's responsible for ruining cinema. He invented digital editing, right?
For saving cinema, for adding a great new layer to it. God.
But this would change everything because, I mean, think of it now. The experimentation. You don't have to, like, break up a film of scissors and splice tape anymore to try an alternate cut.
Right,
and there's going to be the impulse to cut more to where it's like, don't take the Scorsese method in trying to figure out the whole movie ahead of time. You just shoot it from 12 angles and then just give it to the editor to figure out if you're a director nowadays.
I wouldn't do that, but yeah.
That's what I'm saying, though. The industry moved that way.
Right.
It just became easier to shoot coverage and a lot of coverage because attention spans had changed. Obviously, commercials and videos were being cut faster and faster and faster. And that could have had to do with the speed of the music and just the rhythm of different trends is a key thing. But the pacing of movies, to me, has changed dramatically in 20 years.
Yeah.
There's an accelerated sense of pace. And, you know, very few shots hold to let actors give a performance. They're just, it's almost like the editing is dictating the story in some ways, or the rhythms of the movie instead of the story dictating the rhythms.
Well,
in some
and there's
ways.
A lot of reasons for that. I mean, obviously there's the issue of, you know, theater turnover. Let's get it done quick. I mean, remember back in the day when The Abyss came out and it just was unheard of that, you know, The Abyss could come out at near 3 hours. You know, he had to cut out that whole end section with the wave.
Yeah, and cut out 40 minutes.
Oh, my God, it's going to be so long. You know, I think today we're a little better, you know, set up to where everyone's not so freaking scared of that time element.
Well, I'm just in talking about accelerating and pacing of the movies,
too. No, I know.
Things happen
I'm
faster
say,
in movies now, you know?
I'm just looking at possible reasons. I mean, there's that issue. There's obviously, what you know, the you know, let me go back to the MTV thing. I think the influence of montage, the influence of commercials. I think that, you know, and television, you got to remember all these methods are being ported over to television as well, all this bag of tools. And I think what you're seeing is that, you know, the attention span obviously got shorter. I mean, everyone has, you know, attention deficit disorder now, and they can't, you know, watch it. And, if, you know, it's like, oh, it's long. You know, I mean, God, we just saw it this last week with Zodiac, you know, and everyone's like, oh, it's so long. I mean, it's like, shit. Hollywood Saloon.
Got my money's worth. I don't know what you're bitching about.
Well, Hollywood Saloon. You know what I mean? Remember our first shows? Oh, my God. That was like an hour and a half. Podcasts have to be 30 minutes. Don't you know better?
Yeah.
Please. So, and I think that, you know, you're obviously seeing that quite a bit with this pacing upgrade, you know, our speed.
Yeah, and I think digital editing just makes it easier, too.
Yeah, sure.
You know? And I think the tools have become widespread. You know, they get more popular. And, I mean, look at, you know, someone like Oliver Stone. Is it fair to attribute all 4,000 cuts of JFK to Oliver Stone? You know, he approved them.
Right.
But, you know, you've got three or four really, you know, Hank Corwin, the guys that won the Oscar. Really hardworking team of editors who are making stylistic choices with Oliver Stone's footage.
Well, sure.
Basically, Oliver Stone is not sitting over the shoulder of these guys 24 hours a day. These guys are laboring over footage for 8 hours, and Stone is like moving from one editing room to another. And he'll take a scene that one guy does and give it to another, and they'll trade off and they'll cut each other's footage. And then Stone will say, no, do this and change that and whatnot.
Well, that's...
It becomes collaborative,
but it's
not just Oliver Stone is what I'm saying.
No,
I think
of course not.
In the age, I mean, the editors have always been influential.
I always find the editor has more objectivity than the director. Because the editor wasn't on the set. The editor didn't cast the movie. The editor didn't do the storyboards. The editor didn't inundate him or herself with a year and a half of pre-production. So the editor is the most, has the most objective eye in that creative environment.
Their influence to movies is sometimes akin to a director's, because an editor will make style choices and editing choices for a director. An editor might put together a montage that a director wasn't even present for. The editor assembled the footage. The director looks at it and goes, man, that's fantastic.
Well, that's why you hire a particular editor, because his previous work lends its style to the structure of the story that you're going into. I mean, that's why you would hire one person over another person. It's not just, you know, like a court-appointed editor. You know, you just get whoever. Mm-hmm. And hopefully you get a good guy. You go after the people that you think can handle this kind of material. The editor's job is to do that, is to create. And then the director comes in afterwards and says, yes, 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 no. Yes, yes, mm-hmm. yes, no. I mean, I think that's pretty much standard for editing today.
Well, and to be fair, there's a lot of old school directors that didn't even set up their own shots. They had great cinematographers helping them stylize and create inventive ways to photograph a scene. Filmmaking is collaborative. And in essence, style is collaborative.
Sure.
When I'm talking about style, I mean, we didn't define this at the beginning of the show, but you know, we're talking about camera, editing, and design.
Mm-hmm.
Those are kind of the three big tools you have to play with. Design, I'm thinking of someone like, you know, Gilliam or Tim Burton.
Sure.
They're highly stylized in their design, or like Julie K. Moore's films are very highly stylized.
You know when you
see Baz Luhrmann is stylized in his design.
Right.
But also his editing.
Sure.
And also his camera.
Absolutely.
Baz doesn't settle for one. He wants all three.
That's
you
right.
Know?
Thank God.
And Baz is influenced by cinema, the history of cinema. And I think that's why when you look at his movies, you see everything.
Right.
And the kitchen sink thrown in. You know, he's just, he will not reject a technique if he feels like he can work it in and into the stylized concept that he has for his piece.
Someone like Luhrmann doesn't just have a tool belt. He's got a palette. You know what I mean? It's freaking laid out, and he just, you know, runs and grabs and runs and grabs and runs and grabs.
Mm-hmm.
It's all there. I mean, and really, isn't that what we all should be that
and,
way?
You know, he's had the same editor, Jill Bilcock, on his three Red Curtain films, right?
Right.
So obviously there's a relationship going on in there.
Sure.
And they're sensing each other the same way Thelma Schoonmaker works with Scorsese. I mean, I'm sure it's now to where, after so many films, she edits like Marty anyway, right?
Well, sure. She can anticipate what he will want. Oh, mm-hmm. This is what Marty would want.
Yeah.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the essence of collaborative, and that's who, as a director, you want with you. You want someone who understands you. Part of the invention of style, I mean, that's the thing, is that, my God, movies are so huge. Just sit down. Here's my rant. Watch the credits and look at all those names. Mm. My God, how did all these people come together for just this simple 90-minute to 2-hour movie? How did all these names participate, and yet it didn't come out as a jumbled monkey shit mess? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It came out and it did something. You know, how can you even fathom the amount of pre-production, production, et cetera, in making the Lord of the Rings trilogies in one time?
Oh, man.
I mean, that's monumental.
And Peter Jackson acknowledges, I mean, have you seen the assistant director? He's got Jeff Murphy and two other guys.
Right.
These guys are directing second and third units that are more like, you know, first unit B team, you know?
Right.
They're out collecting shots. And, yeah, Jackson's watching them on a monitor and making adjustments, but he's relying on them as creative artists to come in and play in this playground, and all the designers and all the teams. And I think the best filmmakers... And we'll go back to Kubrick. He hired all the best people, right?
Well, that's the point.
And then let them innovate.
The style may be dictated at the top from Kubrick, mm-hmm. or Peter Jackson, or George Lucas.
Mm-hmm.
But
when,
it,
and you
it
see that,
down.
Like, I mean, think about J.J. Abrams. He comes in, he shoots the pilot of Alias.
Right.
And then that dictates the style of the show.
Exactly.
And then all the other episodes will follow that kind of, you know, style that he set up. And, I mean, a lot of shows are like that. It becomes an important part of the stamp, if you will, that yeah. you choose. And the big one of all was Miami Vice. Instead of retreading, I think it pretty much speaks for itself in changing grammar in film and television.
Well, especially for
montage
television,
and everything.
Right, right, especially for
it television. Was, it was just enormous. But you're right. We're now in this age to where... you know, the tools are now available to everybody. Anyone on YouTube can create style. So much style has been thrown at us in the last 10, 15 years.
Right.
And you got to remember, Mulcahy was ridiculed for Highlander when it came out. Mm-hmm. Got horrible reviews, particularly his camera and editing choices. He was ridiculed as just being an MTV stylist. But Highlander looks pretty standard today. You know what I mean? It looks pretty much... business as usual for a typical, you know, of whatever film grammar today. Fincher was criticized for his style in Alien 3. And boy, did everyone nitpick. That's just been the whale that every shark in town's picked off of, you know. Sometimes style is ahead of its time. And, you know, it takes a while for the industry to catch up and to imitate it. I mean, look at Seven. God. That style is so imitated, it makes you sick. You don't even want to see anything that's lit like that anymore, you know, and yeah. it's presenting in that horror, gruesome. Because unlike Seven, they are showing you all the horror crap, you know, the
right.
gruesome gore shots that, I don't know, maybe in their heyday in the 80s, there was a certain cheesiness still to it all. That you could sort of wow at the head exploding in Scanners.
Yeah.
There was a sensational effect about the realism of it. Like, I see the modern trend today with a lot of this sort of torture horror.
Yeah.
But these films rely on a whole toolkit of style. And, boy, you hit it on the head with your imitators.
Yeah.
You know, the and it's a whole generation of directors who... You got to remember, all of these guys in the 70s were influenced by older films that were very content-driven and story-driven, and they brought their style to that. But a newer generation of directors are not too content-driven. They're just visually driven.
Right.
And they're trying to enforce it on their content, on any content they come in contact with. Yeah. You know, it's an interesting story. I'll go back and look at Phil Juanu's first film, 3 O'Clock High. We love the style of that film.
Right.
But to me, that was just dictated, I thought, by After Hours. It was very similar in film, and he was just kind of pushing what Scorsese did even further. Yeah. And he had Barry Sonnenfeld as his, well, the credit says, lighting cameraman. Not director photography, not photographed by, but lighting cameraman.
That's interesting.
And I'll return to that discussion in a future show.
Yeah.
But Sonnenfeld, who had done the Coen Brothers movies, the Blood Simple and the mother of them all, moving camera movies is Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
An orgasmic explosion as well in 1987 that did come out on the same day as Evil Dead 2.
There you go.
And again. Oh. I mean, Sam Raimi was using that to make his film more ferocious and more alive than anything you'd seen before. And his influences from Three Stooges all the way down the line to Mario Bava and all the horror, you know, greats, Toby Hooper,
right.
John Carpenter, everything.
Right.
And it's just, it's such a mixed, wild, crazy bag, and only comes out Sam Raimi.
Right.
And he had a stamp from his first movie on,
sure.
you know? Coen Brothers did, too.
Mm-hmm.
You and I saw Raising Arizona a dozen times, at least.
At least.
I know I saw it at least four or five in the theater.
Yes.
I was just blown away by just the outrageousness of it all, you know?
Absolutely.
And just... and how the style works so seamlessly with the material.
Yeah.
Could wait for Miller's Crossing.
Yeah.
Could wait to see what they did
we
next.
Tried to get a job on Miller's Crossing.
I know. And then it comes, and it's a completely different style.
Yeah, totally.
They changed their film grammar because, well, one, it didn't fit the material they were doing.
Sure.
And two, they had done it. They're
right.
choosing the grammar for the movie instead of bringing the grammar to the movie.
Right.
God, do we just sound like old stuffy professors now? Your film grammar lesson for tomorrow will be...
Well, what you need to do is go back and watch that old stuff. That good old graphic.
But I don't know. It's just, it's different sensibilities. And so I think you see a lot of well-shot commercials and music videos and movies,
right,
but they're just devoid of anything else. And style isn't defined by any one thing. It isn't defined by a camera move or an editing. It can be sometimes a lack of those things that can be a style.
Sure.
And Harris Savides, who photographed Zodiac and The Game for Fincher, has also been working with Gus Van Sant on his realism movies, Jerry, Elephant, and Last Days. Mm-hmm. And these... This is, to me, like the new wave of style, and it's the lack of cutting.
Right.
You know? It's the lack of the wild camera moves. It's the very slow, involving, long shots that just draw you in to where suddenly you even forget you're watching a movie, and you're watching life and reality take place.
Sure.
And all time and all pace and rhythms of movies stop. They're thrown out. You don't have any of those crutches. Mm-hmm. And you're dealing with a different way of... God, I'm going to hate myself for saying this, cinematic expression, you know?
Yeah.
But, and I feel that when I saw, you know, Zodiac as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, then you have a director like Soderbergh. And what I like about Soderbergh is sometimes he edits his own films. Mm-hmm. And he does use Marianne Bernard, which is his mother's maiden name. He doesn't take a credit. Doesn't say edited by Steven Soderbergh.
That's cool. I did not know that. That's very cool. Thank you.
Yeah, and... sometimes he gets, Stephen Maroney, who did Traffic. And mm-hmm. I remember always being so impressed by, you know, Soderbergh as an editor, particularly The Limey, mm-hmm. which I think is a masterful piece of editing and style.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly mimicking a certain type of 60s aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a justification for certain, you know, montage and style that film does take up. Right. But I remember on the commentary for Traffic, you know, Soderbergh talking about how, you know, it was the scene of the kids just talking about drugs. And Soderbergh said, oh, man, I just loaded magazines in the camera and I just shot miles of footage and I just dumped it on Stephen Maroney. And I said, have fun, you know. And then he just poured through it all. He came up with the scene. But there's other times where Soderbergh's cutting his own films and it's very precise and he's making all those choices. But as a filmmaker, he's acknowledging that it is the teamwork creative process. Sometimes certain projects, you want to bring in the best people that are going to help you pull off a certain effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Wes Anderson is highly stylized in his design in
sure.
his films. They're
sure.
always very particularly frame a certain kind of flatness.
Well, they're very kind of vanilla.
Detail.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Very straightforward. There's not a lot of depth in his shots. It's just, here's a medium shot, and here's my character standing right in the middle of it.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's constantly evolving, and I think it's been hitting home to me lately to where I was telling you, it's just, I'm overloaded with it. And then I question the audience, do they even notice it anymore? Like, when they see a series of rapid edits, are they viscerally thrilled by it, or is it just, like, status quo?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, if you didn't do it, could you elicit the same effect from the audience? Like, mm-hmm. why are you going to the trouble to spend 6 hours doing all these intricate 18-frame cuts and all this sequence? And that's one way to do it. And you could do another way that was just 3 or 4 cuts and then you're out. If they both get exactly the same response from the audience, and if the lesser cuts get a better response, why are you going to all the trouble with it all? And I don't know. I guess if the rapid cuts get the most response, which has been trendy for so many years, it's been that way, but I can only speak for myself, but I don't know. I mean, sometimes I turn to people and go, wow, did you notice the editing in that scene? And they're like, no, you know, not really.
Right.
And they're waiting for me to tell them what they were supposed to see kind mm-hmm. of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I question that all the time when I see style, and I don't have the answers. That's the whole thing.
Well, come on. I mean,
this is an ongoing pursuit, but the word tired does come up, and when that happens, you get change. And look what Kubrick did with 2001. He broke all those jump cut, trendy, fast cutting trends of the 60s and slowed down his film dramatically in you know, for those long, right. drawn-out shots, opening with the Dawn of Man and then, you know, everything right. in space. I mean, he completely dictated a new pacing.
Well, it lent itself to the material because flash over to Clockwork Orange, which is nothing like 2001 with its, you know,
exactly.
sequences that are sped up. It all, the smart directors, it will be dictated by the story.
I mean, can you imagine the Barry, you know, people going into Barry Lyndon disappointing because it wasn't Clockwork Orange?
Oh, give me a break.
Oh, God, he didn't do any fast cuts like right. he did in Clockwork. It's like, come on.
Right.
You know, I mean, look at the film you're seeing. It's not, you know, he did something grander than that. You know, he created a lens to show you what scenes look like lit by candlelight because you've never seen it before.
Well, the point is that what we're saying is that the director will bring a style to a particular project if it's called on by the script, and that's what I would hope would happen. But, you know, what you're saying is that today that's not the case, and you're overloaded. Now, and you're tired, okay? I completely understand that. Let me flip the script on you, okay? Here's how I think. Now, I have to bring my certain bias into it. I think, God, and this is going to sound pretentious, forgive me ahead of time, everybody, but I think film is an ongoing discovery journey, okay? Think mm-hmm. about someone going off, you know, in a boat.
No, you're right.
In
it's
a ship.
So young, 110 years
well,
or
but,
so.
What I'm saying is that I think that you have to strike out on journeys to investigate something, okay? I don't if your script dictates a slower pace like let's say M. Night, okay? And the six cuts per movie that he uses or something, okay? Always pre-planned. But then look at what Tony Scott does, okay?
That's now, my next question. Well, do you think the script of Domino dictated what he brought to
well,
it?
No, hold
or
on,
did
hold
Tony
on.
Scott bring that to Domino?
Well, here's what I'm telling you, is that I think that whereas it did work with Man on Fire, okay? And I think what he was trying to bring, the hecticness of you know, someone going after, you know, a kidnapped child, I think he brought it more there. Domino might not have called for it, but what he's doing, and a lot of people don't want to go there. And that's the thing that excites me about what Tony Scott was doing, was that he was saying, I'm going to go for this because I vibe it. I feel it. And if I've got to break down some walls to do it, I'm going to do it. You know, and I'm glad that they allowed him to do that. You know, win or lose, you know. And apparently he lost because the film flopped and everyone hated it and didn't like it. At least there was the attempt to experiment, and that is what excites me, okay? Whether or not it wins or not, whether or not it wins or not. Now, you know, I think the hard thing is that you can't just experiment a lot with other people's money. It's hard to do that.
It's like, how do you know what the boundaries are until you go too far?
Well, sure.
You know, and I want to see the filmmakers out there pushing it. I know Soderbergh had a great quote about Godfrey Reggio, who has done his Coen of Scotsese trilogy
right.
over the years.
I think some people, when they see something that doesn't fit the template that they're used to applying, they want to blame the filmmaker. They think, oh, it's the filmmaker's fault. I've never been that way. I try and open my mind to fit the art instead of trying to chop down the art to fit my mind. I think it's important that we have movies like Nakoikatsi at least available to people, because even for some people, if it turns out to be too far over in one direction, I think it's important to know, well, where is that line? What is too far? You know, somebody needs to be out there sort of charting this territory where few people go and a lot of people that go don't come back. You know, I think it's really great to have somebody out there kind of pushing the edges a little bit.
Coen of Scotsese is one of my all-time favorite films. It's one of the most influential films on me as a filmmaker.
Sure.
But I guess I happen to see it at a time to where every single image in that seemed like a brand new image put on film for the first time. Never seen anything quite like it with all the stop action and the use of using only visuals to tell your story, but the message was always clear.
Right.
The way Philip Glass's score was conceptual to the visuals.
Right.
Nerve-wracking as the, you know, the visuals were in that sense. But if I show Coin of Scotsy to someone today, they're not so impressed by all the visuals in it, because they've seen it in every commercial, every TV, every movie. I mean, Serendipity has some fucking fantastic stop action all the way throughout it. It's a romantic comedy.
Well, but the point is this. A lot of times, we can't always blame it on the film. And you have to go out and stir things up if you want to do something new. And I think, here's what I got to say. It's not always the filmmaker and the filmmaker's fault. It's so easy to shoot something down, but a lot of the time it has to do with what the person who's coming to the table with. Take me to an art museum and I'm bored. Take you to an art museum because you're a different person, and you could probably spend hours looking into the painting, looking at the layers, trying to understand what the painter was intending to create, where he came from, what he was doing, what was going on in his life that inspired him to do this. There's so much layering about why this was, how this happened, and all that kind of stuff. Any work of film, as it progresses, and they're trying to create something new, someone's trying to explore and experiment, I think that you can't always put that out in the marketplace, but yet film is the most costly place to experiment. And that's the thing that hurts, is that now film is relegated to the commercial property. Okay, you have to be able to say, okay, I'm going to experiment and have fun a la Tony Scott in Domino, but it's still got to be commercial. It's still going to make this much money, or I'm not going to get to do, you know, the next film or something. I think the point is that, coming back to me, I'm excited to see him go off and do that win, lose, or draw. Okay?
No, and I think the palette has opened up considerably. I mean, there were a lot of rules in the 80s you didn't do in editing. You didn't see shaky camera shots in the 80s in any movie. You didn't see jump cuts in any mainstream Hollywood movie. There was certainly rules that have been broken down. Nowadays, it's like there are no rules. Anytime you want to jump cut in a sitcom or a TV show or a movie, they just do it. They don't need a reason. Audiences understand it now. It doesn't confuse them.
Right.
They can just compress time in so many ways and using techniques and all of that. And I think there's the audience is more educated because we've seen more movies. We've seen all this now.
Right.
We're smarter, all of us. Come on, you watch movies for 20 years, you're going to see all the techniques flood through.
But that still doesn't dictate what you want to watch and sit down at any given time and put into, okay? You could have great film knowledge in your head and you understand techniques and jump cuts doesn't bother you and you can get through all that stuff without going, huh? But if you still sit down to watch entertainment and someone places quote-unquote art in front of you, you're going to be like, hello, I'm bored. Get this crap out of my face. Mm-hmm. And you're going to hate it. You know, and I think that's one of the things that made me so mad with Domino. And I'm not saying it's art. I'm just saying it was an attempt, you know, to do something different, to push the extreme, to push the medium.
And you need that.
Well, that's what excites me about what Tony Scott was doing. And I want him to continue down that. I would be behind anyone doing that. Now, whether or not it's commercial or not will dictate whether he can do that on a larger scale. If he can't, well, then maybe he can do more cool things like the James Brown car commercial. Hopefully he's not the only one that's going to attempt to do stuff like that. That's exciting. You can't necessarily, like I said, do it on that grand of a scale. But I sure would hate if we continue in this pattern and everything only being a commercial product shuts down experimentation and going off in that ship like Columbus and not necessarily knowing where you're going and finding out, because the great filmmakers, including David Fincher of today, were born in that kind of a desire to say, I'm going to go out into this world of style with my bag of tools that I gained from the love of movies, from watching these old masters. And I'm going to go and I'm going to experiment. I'm going to go and try to create. That's the difference between Fincher and Ratner, okay? Ratner is a director for hire. He can get the job done, yada, 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 work for the executive, you know, pimped out for the, you know, for the executive. And that's the difference. He's not interested in finding new territory. He's interested in just producing product.
What's Michael Bay interested in?
Michael Bay is interested in producing product. Okay, and he will use whatever tool he has to do to produce that product. And he won't lie about it, too. I respect the hell out of him for that. He says, I'm making popcorn. You got a problem with that?
Heck no, he's keeping theater owners happy. They love him.
They're not proving our argument that says we want more people to go out there like Fincher and to experiment and to look for new territory and look for new ground. They're just saying, give us the same old, same old. You know, give us city slickers on motorcycles. You know, give us our popcorn junk so we can move on to the next and move on to the next. They're proving that. And you know what? If it's going to continue, it's just going to continue. Oh, well, you know, so much for the experimenters. Let's just hope that more people take up something like Spike Lee, you know, when he made Bamboozled and said, okay, well, I'm going to just shoot it on video and make it affordable and create something that doesn't have to be a major blockbuster for me to create it. You know, let's hope that that trend continues.
Following Joe Gideon's triumphant directorial achievement with 50 Beautiful Girls 50, when he won every possible award, it would be nice to report that Mr. Gideon's latest effort, The Stand-Up, starring Davis Newman, was a better film. The Stand-Up, however, does not quite stand up.
Joey,
even toward the frenetic, Gideon falls into his characteristic weakness of trying too hard to please, to entertain. Slickness obscures reality. The old razzle-dazzle sometimes obliterates drama. Had Gideon trusted the truth of his story, the trials and tribulations of an alcoholic nightclub comic, we might have had a film to equal the best. Frantic cutting. An ear-splitting soundtrack, chopping off the ends of scenes before the drama has played out, left this reviewer with bewilderment and a four-aspirin headache. Using my four-balloon rating system, I give The Stand-Up half a balloon.
Okay, going to wrap up this episode of The Hollywood Saloon. We invite you to come to our website at www.hollywoodsaloon.com. You can get in touch with John or I at hollywoodsaloon@yahoo.com. We'd also like to invite you to our discussion forums. You can get there by coming to our main page at hollywoodsaloon.com. On the left side, it says discussion forums. We've got a great community. Everything is going great over there. A lot of people talking about a lot of things, a lot of summer movies and whatnot. So, hey, if you haven't got on board yet, you need to come get on board, talk to us, and see what's up with the Hollywood Saloon. Pretty much that's it for now. Just want to thank you guys for hanging with us, hanging in there. We hope you enjoyed this look into film style. And we'll be back real soon with another episode. So thanks a lot, and we'll see you next time.
Where's the shot?
What shot?
I took out the shot.
Which shot is that?
The money shot. Bus driver's head. The brains on the window shot. The viscer on the visor shot.
Davis, we thought we'd show it to you like this, you know, without all that.
Put it back. Don't show me anything.
You don't need it. Hey, you're not even giving it a chance.
How's the rearview mirror gag supposed to work without it? Am I the only one here who respects the writing?
You're listening to The Hollywood Saloon.